The following podcast contains explicit language.
Today is Tuesday, February 21st, 2017, and this is The Gist. I'm Maria Konnikova, in for Mike Pesca. And that's not bullshit, but it's kind of bullshit that he gets to go on vacation in Florida while I am stuck here in cold and snowy New York. But that's not what we're going to be talking about today. I was looking at my Twitter feed this morning because that's how I always get my news first thing when I wake up. And for the last, I don't know how many months, it's been full of Trump. But this morning was actually different. It was full of Milo. That's Milo Yiannopoulos, who you might remember for being banned from Twitter 3 times, the last time permanently for his lovely remarks about Leslie Jones when Ghostbusters came out. The time before that was for saying some lovely things about Islam in the wake of the Orlando shootings. And the first time was for saying some lovely things about BuzzFeed and calling himself BuzzFeed's social justice editor. You might also remember that he got a book deal for around $250,000 from Simon & Schuster. And once again, that played out in a Twitter controversy when Roxane Gay announced that she herself was going to be pulling her book from Simon & Schuster if they were going to be publishing Milo. This weekend, a video surfaced from January 2016 in which Milo seems to condone sex with 13-year-old boys. He says that the age of consent is not this black and white thing, and that relationships between younger boys and older men can be hugely positive experiences.
We're talking about 13, 25, 13, 28. These things do happen perfectly consensually.
This 13-year-old boy sex thing seemed to have crossed one too many lines. So a few things happened as a result. One, the American Conservative Union pulled back its invitation for him to speak at the Conservative Political Action Conference. And two, Simon & Schuster canceled the publication of Dangerous, which, by the way, as of yesterday, was still number 83 on Amazon's bestseller list. Now it has been pulled, so it's no longer on the list. And so what does Milo do in response? He issues an apology. And in case you can't hear the air quotes, let me just reiterate, I'm saying apology in air quotes. This is what he posted on Facebook. My own experiences as a victim led me to believe I could say anything I wanted to on this subject, no matter how outrageous. But I understand that my usual blend of British sarcasm, provocation, and gallows humor might have come across as flippancy, a lack of care for other victims, or worse, advocacy. I deeply regret that. People deal with things from their past in different ways. Well, yeah, they do, but not normally in quite this way, and not normally by not really apologizing, but just dismissing this all as British sarcasm mixed with gallows humor. And he did actually apologize for one thing. He said, "I shouldn't have used the word boy," which gay men often do to describe young men of consenting age instead of young men. That was an error. I am certainly guilty of imprecise language, which I regret. So this is the sort of apology that we actually should be pretty used to, because it's the way that Donald Trump himself and almost all members of his administration have been non-apologizing. They've been, you know, saying completely outrageous things, and then instead of saying sorry, have been saying, yeah, it's not so bad. I was taken out of context. You know, she deserved it. What, I'm a big man with big hands. How did we even get here? I mean, how do we get to the feeling of, I could say anything I wanted to, no matter how outrageous, and it's taken this long for me to lose $250,000 book deal? I mean, first of all, I got offered $250,000 book deal for saying these things in the first place. How did we get here? So on today's spiel, we're actually going to be talking about the psychology of life under Trump and what Trump does to our brains and how we can get to statements like Milo's. What happens when you're constantly surrounded by these kinds of statements, by lies? I know there's something very emotional that happens to me personally when I experience something like Milo. I stop thinking rationally, and my decisions get skewed and totally out of whack. And in one word, I go on tilt. I begin to tilt. So that's not a psychological term, actually, but it's a very real one, and it comes from the world of poker. To tilt is to react to something emotionally, when something gets you so much that you stop making good decisions and that you stop thinking well and thoroughly. And actually joining me today is someone who can speak to that phenomenon, explain it, and help us get over it. That will be world poker champion Annie Duke.
The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay the neighbor and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we gvel. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.
I am so thrilled to have Annie Duke here with us. Most of you probably know her as a world poker champion. She holds a World Series bracelet and is formerly the highest earning female poker player in the world, and has also written 4 books on poker and is now writing a 5th, right, Annie?
Yeah, but this book is not about poker. So it is about a wholly different topic. And I'm very far along. I'm actually putting the finishes touches on the last chapter tonight after this. Well, that's what I'm doing next.
Congratulations. Yeah. Congratulations. Thank you. And thank you for coming here to procrastinate with us.
Well, you know, I'm always looking for that opportunity, I have to say.
So we were just talking about tilt, which is when you let your emotions get the better of your decision making, when something pisses you off so much that all of a sudden you just aren't thinking clearly and your decision quality suffers. And I know that this is something that you actually know a lot about, because the term tilt comes from poker.
Poker players express this thing, which is having really bad things happen to you that then you react to really negatively in an emotional sense, that then kind of shuts down your ability to make good decisions going forward. So then you have more bad outcomes and it kind of builds on itself. So that's a really long thing to say. And so they've developed this word tilt, which comes from pinball. You know, when you shake the machine, the pinball machine breaks, you know, just stops working. We can think about it as when you shake the amygdala, the prefrontal cortex just stops working. So that's really where that idea of tilt comes from, is this kind of shutdown of rational thought and rational decision making. And one of the things I talk about is that it's really interesting, because poker players kind of have this advantage and disadvantage to this constantly updated scoreboard, right? So it's this very unusual world where after pretty much any decision you make, there's this chip exchange that happens, right? So you kind of see that there's this score being kept all the time. And it's a little bit different than what happens in life. Like if you make a winning or losing eating decision, right? So you decide that you're going to eat snack wells instead of apples. You don't necessarily after the first snack well see that there's been some sort of exchange that's happened, right? It takes time for those to kind of reveal themselves. But in poker, you're having that chip exchange happen right away. And that's a good thing in the sense that you're very aware that all these small executional decisions have risk associated with them. But it's bad in the sense that it encourages ticker watching. You know, we can think about ticker watching like, you know, in a stock. If you have a long-term hold on a stock, but you look at it at any given moment, it can appear to have very big fluctuations that you can essentially overreact to, right? Because you've kind of zoomed in and you're not really zoomed out. And when you zoom in like that and you start ticker watching, you have these very strong emotional reactions. So it's something that poker players think about a lot. Is trying to avoid the emotional reaction you have to what's happening is that ticker ticks up or down.
How do you resolve it? I mean,
so I can help you with this. you resolve it through time traveling, really, is the main way that you do it. So, you know, we all have heard in movies that if different versions of yourself ever meet up, you know, you sort of, the time-space continuum rips apart and universe explodes.
Yep, I think it literally explodes, yep.
I think it literally explodes. So that's a device that's used in movies a lot. But actually, it's the opposite. It not only doesn't explode, but it really helps your decision-making. You can think about this problem of ticker watching as really a perspective problem, that you're not bringing in kind of past and future versions of yourself, right? So what if you thought about yourself more like a happiness stock, right? And you kind of want your stock to go up, like Berkshire Hathaway. But if you zoom in on any given moment, you don't see that there's just kind of this upward trend. Mm-hmm. So what you want to do is figure out ways that you can get yourself out of the moment and get the perspective of time. Mm-hmm. You know, think about, well, how would I feel about this if it had happened a year ago? Or how would I feel about this? How do I think I'll feel about this in a year? Do I think that this will really matter? So, you know, one of the examples I give is if you're like on the side of the road and it's raining and you have a flat tire and you're freezing cold and you go to change the tire and you have no jack, you're so unhappy. Oh my God. But if I were to stop you in that moment, I would say, well, if this had happened a year ago, do you think that it would matter at all to your happiness right now? The answer is like, no, it might enhance your happiness because now you have a funny story to tell at a cocktail party. So it does all this great stuff to calm you down and bring you out of that ticker watching moment into perspective.
So what happens when, you know, hypothetically speaking, of course, we find ourselves in a political context that tilts us all the time? So, you know, earlier today when I was talking about tilt, it was in response to a certain man named Milo Yiannopoulos, who had made some interesting remarks. And I was just thinking, oh my God, I'm tilting. And every time I hear something like this, I found myself, you know, the past few months, I'm in this constant state, which it's not something that I have control over, right? I have control over myself, mm-hmm. but it's not like I'm making bad decisions. It's just all of this stuff happening politically around me mm-hmm. that is making me kind of tilt a little bit. How do we use time travel, or what do we do then? How do we improve our skills so that we don't let that get to us, or do let it get to us, but somehow, I don't know, deal with it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that I would say to that is that it has to do with what good is it doing? Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that that's that moment where you're complete, you know, where you're really on tilt and you say to yourself, well, is it doing any good for me to feel this way?
Right.
Is this helpful to me? Is it helpful to anybody else? Where you feel yourself doing that. And if you go through that set of questions, I think there's a couple of things that can happen. One of them is that your answer can be, well, I'm not making any important decisions right now. And I just need to complain. Like, I just need to offload kind of what's going on. And that's okay. Like, I think you're totally allowed to say, I need a second just to really kind of get this out. Mm-hmm. And I'm not making any decisions. You know, I'm not driving a car impaired or, you know, screaming at someone because I'm on tilt about Milo. I just really feel like I need to offload that. And mm-hmm. and recognizing that that's something that you need to do is totally fine. The problem is when it starts to make it so that you're unproductive in your life. And the nice thing about asking that kind of question of, is this helping anybody? Is this helping me?
Sure.
Is that it starts to get you to think about ways that you can channel what you're feeling about that into something that's productive, right? And to say, okay, well, I can't control this guy that's putting me on tilt. There's nothing I can't really do anything about it. So I have some choices. I can ignore it. We all have that. That's part of the First Amendment, right? Is you can tune it out. So you can ignore it. You can donate to organizations that you feel are going to be helpful that way. You can get involved yourself. You can speak up. You can start going through for whatever your values are. How do I turn this into something that's productive?
Yep.
But when you're doing that, it calms you down.
Sure.
The thing that I really want to say, though, is that it's really important to recognize that sometimes you really do just need to offload the emotion. It's just that you're not making decisions at the moment that you're doing that. That's totally fine. And I think we need to have compassion for ourselves for that.
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to, as soon as we're done talking, I'm going to go offload some emotion on a whole bunch of people. I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on kind of modern politics kind of through a poker lens. I couldn't help but think, you know, throughout the election, even now, like a lot of what's happening seems to be very poker-like in terms of, you know, who's bluffing whom. Like, do you ever think of kind of the political system in that type of lens, through that lens, in those terms?
I imagine I think of everything through that lens. The thing that that I'm most fascinated about right now, and actually most worried about, is really goes into the kind of the motivated reasoning category, mm-hmm. which is it's a really huge problem in poker.
And can you explain for our listeners, sure. who might not know what motivated reasoning is, what that
Absolutely.
Is?
Absolutely. So here's the thing. Decisions that you make are really bets, right? You have an uncertain future because there's many possible futures that can occur. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to determine what decision, you know, sort of what future you want to move to, but you're making a bet on it because it's not certain. And you're doing that based on incomplete information and that there's sort of luck in what the result is, right? Mm-hmm. So we don't have perfect knowledge of the world. We don't have perfect knowledge of what's 100% correct or 100% not. And there's luck. So that makes this whole decision-making thing really hard. But we do have beliefs about things, right? We have beliefs about politics, for example, like what you were just talking about.
Sure.
So we place these bets, right? We make decisions based on our beliefs. So you have to really be vigilant in poker to try to kind of deal with this problem that if we lose a hand, we'll just say, oh, we got unlucky. And we have this really strong tendency to do that, which is a really good way to discredit the data. And if we win a hand, we say, oh, we're so great, which confirms our belief that we're awesome players. And so you're really trying to deal with this. So you can see this in the what's sort of happening in politics right now, right? Like fake news.
Right.
People sort of say, well, how could that happen, right? How could someone believe some crazy story? Well, because you hear it, you believe it. If it aligns with your worldview already, right? Mm-hmm. If it aligns with, you know, I hate Democrats, and so that has to be true, or I hate Republicans, and so that has to be true, then we don't really try to discredit it at all, right? We don't think that critically about it. As new stuff comes in that might tell us that that fake news story is not true, we find ways to discredit it, which can go all the way to, you know, something like, well, Sandy Hook was a conspiracy of the government, and they filmed it with actors. Right. So that's kind of the farthest reaches of working very hard to discredit information that disagrees with you.
Right. So then the big question that is certainly on my mind after hearing that is, so how do we become a better poker player? How do we train ourselves to not consume that fake news and to get past motivated reasoning?
So my thing about this is always, anytime that you're certain something is true because it agrees with you, you should really watch out. So anytime you're saying it's 100% or I knew it or that's definitely true or I know that's right or those kinds of things, you should really be trying to back off those kinds of statements, right? And invite people into your uncertainty with you. Because when you invite people into your uncertainty with you and express things in a probabilistic way, it lets them know that you are information seeking.
I don't know, Annie. So, I'm right. I think I'm always right.
So if you think about poker, like poker, you're always thinking that way, right?
Yep.
Like, well, I think I'm about 80% to win this hand. So notice you're never saying like, I'm sure.
Right.
Right. It's like, and by the way, 80% would really be really high. You're very often saying like, I think I'm like 55, 45. And if I express my opinions to you that way, notice that a few really great things happen from it. One is like, if I say to you, you know, well, I'm pretty sure that if you have stricter gun control laws that, you know, crime will go down. But like, you know, I might have seen statistics either way. I'm like 82% on that.
Right.
What does that tell you? It tells you, number one, that I'm open-minded and I'm willing to hear your dissent. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, it makes me very credible because it means that I've actually done some vetting before I've expressed the opinion. I've thought about it. Right. I've thought mm-hmm. about what my information is and that kind of thing. Number three, and this is the most important, it invites you to become a scientist with me. It invites you to offer me up helpful information that might help me refine my opinion. Because if I express it as an opinion that I'm 100% sure about, there's two reasons that you won't necessarily give me the information that you might have that would be relevant to me.
Mm-hmm.
Reason number one is that you might think you're wrong and be embarrassed to tell me
mm-hmm.
because you're worried that I'll judge you for it.
Yep.
Reason number two is you might think that I'm wrong and not want to embarrass me.
Mm-hmm.
And so you won't tell me. And so you keep your mouth shut. And that's very often the case. Like, people keep their mouth shut when they have an opposing opinion or information that maybe disagrees with somebody when somebody has expressed such certainty. So backing off the certainty is really great.
Well, I think that that's very good advice, and I am ready to join you and become scientists together as we as we strive to make the world a better place.
Yay.
No, yay. Seriously, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Annie Duke is a poker player, an author, and the founder of How I Decide. It's online at howidecide.org. And now, the spiel. 1 month ago, Donald Trump became the 45th president of the United States, and in that time, he has proven to be the single most popular president in modern history. His approval ratings are unprecedented. The attendance at his Floridian rallies, likewise unprecedented. And not only was his victory margin the largest ever, and the crowds at his inauguration obviously the largest ever, but everything about him remains, a month in, the largest and the best. See what I did there? Some of what I said is actually true. Like, Donald Trump is indeed our 45th president, and he was inaugurated a month ago. But a lot of it is completely false, and a lot of it is partly false. Here's what Trump does over and over and over again. Today on The Spiel, we're not going to be talking about politics as such. Instead, I want to do a little bit of a psychological analysis of some of Trump's techniques. So, what are the practical effects of what Donald Trump, the 45th president of the country — I still get shivers every time I say that — what are the practical effects of what he's doing to our brains? What is going on with us? According to PolitiFact, some 70% of our president's statements are lies. Our brains are not equipped to deal with a constant stream of lies. So at Harvard University, there's a psychologist, Daniel Gilbert, who studies how we actually perceive the world. And he has come up with a two-step model of reality processing. So first, we actually think of every single thing in the world as true, which makes perfect sense. I mean, you cannot go around questioning whether what you're hearing right now actually exists, whether your world exists. You have to accept reality or you're going to go insane. The second step is verification. So is this actually true or false? So first, you take those default true statements and then you either say, okay, true, or you say, actually, no, false. And so now your brain recodes it as false. But that is the second step, and that requires effort. So true requires no effort. That's what our brains do automatically. False requires effort. And that process is often disrupted, especially when you have a lot of things going on. So Mike and I have talked on the show before about cognitive load. So what happens when your brain is totally overloaded, when you have so many things going on? And psychologists use this all the time to disrupt people's thinking so that they can look at all sorts of different effects in the lab. But what happens outside the lab when you suddenly, your whole world gets turned topsy-turvy and every single fact is a fact that you have to say true or false? It's exhausting. And so some of those facts end up just going through because you don't have the mental bandwidth to deal with them. So let's think about this in the context of other politicians, right? Politicians aren't exactly known for telling the truth. All politicians lie to some extent or another, and some get into a lot of trouble for those lies. So you might remember Bill Clinton and his famous claim that
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
It's a claim that got him impeached. Now, imagine if Donald Trump had said that. I did not have sex with that woman amidst all of the other lies that we hear from him every single day. With Clinton, it's so easy to pick it apart because it's one statement, standalone, on its own. We can devote all of our mental resources to figuring out whether or not it's actually true. With Trump, we are already so depleted and there are already so many lies out there. What's one more? And how important is this one in the scale of all the other ones? You know, where does having sex with that woman compare with election fraud or inauguration numbers or Swedish terrorist attacks? It's really difficult to know. But it's not just the volume of lies. It's also that Donald Trump repeats his lies over and over and over. When a false fact has been repeated enough times, our mind often starts processing it as true, even if the fact is a pretty simple one. There was a study done a few years ago, and the results have actually been repeated multiple times, where students were shown a group of statements and they had to mark those statements as either true or false. Then a few weeks later, they saw another list and some of the statements repeated. And again, they had to say true or false. And this included things like, the Atlantic Ocean is bigger than the Pacific Ocean. Now, we know that the Pacific Ocean is actually almost two times as large as the Atlantic. And the first time around, basically everyone marked this as false. However, when they heard it a second time, and sometimes even a third time, people started marking it as true, even though they knew that this was a false fact. And we know they knew because they had originally known it was false and marked it as false. What happens? You hear it so often that your brain gets used to it. And all of a sudden, you know, it's not like you go around every single day thinking which ocean is bigger. You say, oh, maybe I forgot. Maybe I got mixed up. Maybe the Atlantic really is bigger than the Pacific. Now, imagine when that's happening from the president in politics every single day. Let me give you an example that even people who hate Donald Trump often cite. At least Donald Trump is a good businessman. Let's just back up a second and look at his actual business record. The guy has declared bankruptcy multiple times. According to one estimate, he would be wealthier now if he had not invested any of his money that his father had given him and had just instead given it to someone else to invest in, you know, a mutual fund with steady returns, that he would actually have more money right now. And earlier today, we spoke with Annie Duke, who is obviously in the poker world. And, you know, her home for many years was a casino. And a casino is one of the best businesses in the world because, you know, the house always wins. And Donald Trump managed to run a casino into the ground. I mean, that's a great businessman for you. You take a business where every single game is built with an advantage for the house, even something like poker, where every single pot gets a rake to the house, so the house wins no matter what, and you bankrupt it. Donald Trump is not a good businessman, but for years, he has been telling us that he is, and the media coverage and shows like The Apprentice have really carried that message through. And so it has all built up this illusory truth effect. And illusory truth is incredibly sticky. One thing that Trump does incredibly well, and I think he has no idea he's doing it, he just kind of does it naturally, is when he refutes people's refutations of him. So when he actually tries to say, no, what I'm saying is true, even though it's false, he never repeats the true statement because he knows that repetition makes things sound more true. I don't think, once again, I don't think he actually knows it, but he somehow senses it and he uses this. So let's listen to this clip from his press conference last week.
I guess it was the biggest electoral college win since Ronald Reagan.
Now, a reporter then asks him to follow up and says, actually, no, you know,
President Obama got 365.
Well, I'm talking about Republican.
Instead of actually addressing that statement, he gives you another one. I meant Republicans. And now we've got that. And so the same dogged reporter, you know, he just won't be let down, says,
the question is, why should Americans trust you when you accuse the information they receive of being fake when you're providing information that's
well,
not accurate?
Well, I was given that information. I've seen that information around, but it was a very substantial victory. Do you agree with that?
You're the president.
Okay, thank you. That's a good answer. Yes.
So we know from psychological studies that even if people know that information is false and that it's been retracted, if it's been kind of planted in their minds initially, they keep using it to make their decisions. So Colleen Seifert, who's a psychologist at the University of Michigan, did a series of studies where she would tell people stories about police reports. For instance, you know, there were gas containers and paint cans and there was a fire. What do you think started the fire? And then she would actually retract the information. She said, sorry, the initial reports were wrong. There were no gas cylinders. There was no paint on premises. And people say, okay, I understand. There was nothing there. And yet when she asks what started the fire, they say, oh, the gas, or oh, the paint. And when you point out the fact that, hey, you just said that you understood that it wasn't there, rather than say, I made a mistake, they say, oh, well, there was gas at first, and then it was moved off the premises. So the scariest thing to me isn't that our brains aren't particularly good at correcting false information. It's how readily we use false information to warp existing reality and create a new reality that actually is based in lies. The Gist is produced by Mary Wilson and Chris Berube. Steve Lichtai is the head of Slate Podcasts, and Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network. Mike Pesca is back tomorrow, along with your more creative credits. I'm Maria Konnikova. Thanks for listening.